there seems to be a whole group of people downstairs that are still waiting to get in. So, which is fine because this first session that we're gonna do, a lot of people have actually seen it, and I've tried to kind of mix it up a little bit to not make it the same old thing that I've done before. But truth be told, we can't do a WCF event like this that kind of takes the soup to nuts in WCF without giving you an introduction to the technology and showing you the fundamentals and the essentials for building services. So who here has seen me do this presentation at a code camp or at a user group? Wow, that's actually excellent. So most of you are new to this. That's good. Charles has seen it, I think, maybe 13, 14 times. And you still come back for more torture? This is Charles. He's my official target for the day. So I'm going to introduce you to the world of WCF and service orientation. We're going to start talking about service orientation first because that's really the architecture paradigm that WCF was developed to handle, to provide plumbing for. So we're going to talk about SOA. We're going to introduce WCF. Who here does some WCF work already? You don't have to raise your hand for anything, all right? Otherwise, you're going to be like this all day. Exactly. I'm going to describe it, give you a little bit of a history of how we came to WCF. Important, why do you want to use it? Why is it important? This is a very important part of today because we're going to show you a lot of technology, and with new technology comes new ways of writing code. And in the case of service orientation, there is usually some extra code you need to write. Do I need... Give me 1 second. What was that question? How is it different from what? I'm not familiar with IBM solutions, so I really can't talk about it. Is this better? Yeah. All right. And then we're going to jump right in, and we're going to create this stuff. You know, part of my goal here today is to show you that this is not a cryptic technology. It's not something that's very, very difficult. It's not rocket science. You can really hit the ground running and write services within an hour and a half of looking at me do it. So I'm going to design an entire little service-oriented application using WCF from scratch for you here. And I need to make sure I keep track of my timings here. So this is the definition of service-oriented architecture. So there's the decomposition of a system into autonomous, I'm going to add to this, or semi-autonomous, discoverable and secure units of responsibility, and the interoperable exposure of said units. Sounds pretty high-tech, sounds pretty advanced, okay? So for a very cool T-shirt, where's this definition from? How many people think it's from A, Martin Fowler's Patterns of Enterprise Application Architecture? This is like the Bible of architecture books, right? How many people think it's Microsoft Patterns and Practices SOA Guidelines? How many people think I made it up myself? I don't know how to give this out. I really don't. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to throw two of them out there, okay? I'm going to throw one on each side. The answer is C. I made this up myself. All right? So where are the big guys at? Where do the XL needs to be thrown? The XL needs to be thrown on this side. So I'm just going to take this. Now, you got to wear this shirt, okay? You got to wear this shirt. I'm sorry. I got to do it like this, man. You got it? All right. Here we go. Got it. All right. You got to wear the shirt. All right. Hold it up. Hold it up for everybody to see.
It'll be a little warm.
Those were actually a goof. A very appreciative client of mine. I'll bring you one another day. I have more. A very appreciative client of mine actually had those printed for me and told me you got to give them away as prizes. I said I got to give them away as last place, not first place, you know? All right. So service-oriented architecture separates applications into services. It's designed to help you break down an application into these autonomous units of responsibility. Services themselves become kind of managers, okay? They're orchestrators, and they usually consolidate multiple, one or more calls to down-level layers. So you're not losing everything that you know already. You're not losing the ability to do multi-tier architecture. It just sits behind another wall now. Very important, they allow the connectivity of dissimilar technologies. The concept of service orientation means that behind a service, you have all of these paradigms, design patterns, architecture layers that you're used to seeing. But between services or communication between client and services, you have industry standard protocol, which means it doesn't have to be .NET that's talking to services. So interoperability is a big, big deal with service orientation. This is not a product. I gotta say this. I know it sounds obvious, but I still get people that ask me, where can I buy an SOA platform? And it's not a product. It's not something you buy. This is an architecture. It's a design paradigm. These are sets of design principles. It is the next evolution of programming paradigms because it brings together a lot of programming paradigms that we're used to seeing. So back in the days of procedural programming, who goes back to this day besides me and Don? So we used to do procedural programming all the time. I mean, back in Quick Basic 4.5, remember that, Eric? Where'd he go? He left. He left his iPad, though. There's a free iPad sitting right on the desk. So, you know, applications were developed by constantly calling procedures, constantly calling functions. We had very, very limited use of wrapping things up into these little things. We didn't have any analogy to real-world design, nothing to relate a list of procedures to the real-world entities that this application was meant to emulate. So later came the world of object orientation, and can you read the white letters on there? I should have changed that to black. So object orientation kind of took procedural programming to the next level by giving us the analogy of real-world entities in the world of software design. So now the car and the bus that we were writing software about became car and bus objects. And the ability for this car to have four tires and a steering wheel became properties of these objects. So there was an analogy there between real world and software design. The ability for a car to move forward and then move in reverse became methods of objects. It became actions or behaviors, as we call it. So we had an analogy, something that our brain can relate to a little better when we're designing software. You are so lucky that thing is still sitting on your. This, with this crowd, this is New York. Remember, that iPad's going to sit here for about 5 minutes, okay?
How was you watching it?
So then we came up to, well, object-oriented programming had one major drawback, okay? A lot of people seem to think that object-oriented programming failed because of this. It didn't fail. It just still needed something, and that is that it was great within a single application, but there was no easy way of reusing an object outside of its application. There was no automatic plumbing around it. Along came the world of component-oriented programming and something that Microsoft called COM. IBM had their version called CORBA or something like that, Cobra. One of them is the insurance benefits, and the other one's the COM thing. CORBA and Cobra. So COM kind of added a layer of plumbing, whereas an object can talk to another object in dissimilar applications, still binary. So there was still a limitation there, but if we're within the same binary compatible system, like let's say a Windows system, we now have the ability for a DLL written in C++ in an object-oriented fashion to be used from a VB6 application or a VB3 or 4 or whatever it actually was for. But we were still missing a lot because in enterprise design, there's a lot of stuff you got to worry about besides objects talking to each other. You got to worry about how objects are instantiated. You got to worry about how concurrency is handled, you know, how locks are set, that kind of thing. You got to worry about transactions. That's a huge topic. We're going to be talking about it and demoing it later on. And COM didn't solve any of these problems. They try to bring into the picture something called enterprise services, which sat on top of COM Plus, very, very cryptic to use, was not the easiest thing in the world. But the next evolution of design gave us service orientation, where we were now able to expose everything that we did from COM, component object-oriented programming, down, expose it as services to the outside world, thus making it truly interoperable, and then with the proper technology, add all of these different things that I just spoke about. So the concept of SOA gives us the ability to do this, but not the technique on how to do it. It doesn't give us the technology. This is where WCF comes in. WCF is a technology that, when mixed with the design of service orientation, lets us expose everything that you're familiar with today, which are conventional objects, object orientation, properties and methods, everything that you've been using for a long time. We can now expose it to the outside world for true interoperability, and we can orchestrate it and manage it in a way that we can handle concurrency issues. We can handle different ways of instantiation. We can handle transaction propagation. Who agrees with me that transactions are super important in our world? If you don't think transactions are important, get out of the business right now. I can't be any more blunt. Transactions are very important, and those three things that I just spoke of, instancing, concurrency, and transactions, we're going to be talking about them in detail in the following session. So SOA is not a replacement for components or objects. And I have to say statements like this that sound kind of obvious because I still get people from the real diehard object purist world that say they don't like SOA because we've gone backwards to procedural programming. That's not true. It's not true at all. Yes, you are exposing a kind of quasi-procedural layer to the outside world, but what you're doing behind the service is still all the good, cool things that we've been taught to do for a long time. So your knowledge is heavily leveraged. It's not being replaced. Now, that being said, this will not help you fix bad architecture practices, which means if you were jumping tiers, if you were calling your ADO.NET connections or commands from your Windows form or from your web form, and if you're actually doing that, please do not tell me because I'm going to blog about you, I'm going to ridicule you, and we're being recorded here, all right? And you'll never work in this town again, as they say. But if you were doing all these bad architecture practices of jumping tiers, of circular references in your object, that kind of bad stuff, you can still make those mistakes because, like I said, what sits behind the service wall is still the good old-fashioned object stuff that we've been working with for a long time. So you got to keep that in mind. This will not keep you 100% honest. So here's an example of a service-oriented architecture, okay? As you can see, we got our client tiers up at the top, and we got stuff that you're familiar with here. Here's our business engine, whether it's a true business layer, whether it's an ORM layer, whatever it is that you decide. And I'm not here to talk those kind of details or to recommend which is better. Some people like both, a business layer talking to an ORM layer, then it talks to a data layer. In this case, we got a slash business ORM. We got it talking to a data access layer, which in turn is talking to a database. This is what you've been familiar with for a very long time. The difference is that instead of this business tier being called by the clients here, we now have this service layer in between. And the service layer helps us orchestrate multiple calls here because before, in order to post an order somewhere, we may have to call an order object and write out an order. We may have to update some product information. We may have to send out an email to the notification email, a bunch of different things. Normally, it would be the job of the clients here to make a call to these objects, and we can encapsulate a lot of the functionality in the object. But the client tier would still be responsible for making the initial calls. Now it's a matter of the client tier sending a message to a service tier, a service layer, telling it, here's all the information you need to make this order happen. Please go take care of this. And the service layer will call the business engine for the order stuff, and it'll call another product engine to update this, and it'll call a notification engine and send an email out. It'll do all these things, all done it in a nicely orchestrated fashion. And guess what? All nicely done within a single transaction. See how important that becomes when you have something like an e-commerce system? As far as what talks to the services, you'll learn about that in a few minutes. It's something called service proxies. Some people refer to it as a business client layer. There is a reason I called it a business client layer. Not only are proxies capable of talking to services, but the proxies themselves are objects, and these are objects that can be bound. And I'm not here to show you a demo of that, but I want to mention that because one of the things that people love about interacting with objects is that we can bind them. We can bind them to data grids. We can bind them to forms, especially with WPF today, where you can bind yourself to binding hell. You think DLL hell was bad? Wait till you see binding hell with WPF. With service proxies, you can bind those things too. So you don't lose any of these cool binding techniques that you've grown to know and love when you go the SOA route. One more thing, regarding what I said about making the same mistakes, if you were one of those programmers that used to, call this layer right from this one, you can still make that mistake by calling it from this one. So those bad architecture practices are not going to be enforced just because you're going the SOA route. You still need to be a good developer, okay? We're not here to teach you how to cut corners. All right, so a service, which is the whole unit that we're talking about here that we got up so early in the morning today. Who came out from New Jersey, by the way? Anybody run into that problem in the Lincoln Tunnel? Yeah, I caught it right at the last moment. Right when I saw the traffic stopped, I managed to get off on that exit, and I followed it on a parallel road, so I managed to avoid it, but I came very close. So a service is pretty much an encapsulated unit of responsibility. They are atomic, so more often than not, they don't break down into anything smaller. They're a very self, kind of little black box that does one thing, and it does it very, very well. It has the capability of being durable, meaning with the assistance of WCF, services are able to maintain state if they need to. They're definitely secure. That's a key thing, because when you're opening up your previously binary-only world of objects to the outside world through messaging, by putting a service layer on it, security becomes a very important piece of information here. And because of the way they handle transactions, services are now able to leave systems in a very consistent state. And this has to do with transactions. It has to do with the fact that if one little piece fails, everything is going to be backed out. Now think of that e-commerce thing. What it takes to purchase a product on an e-commerce site, you have an order that's assigned to you. The order, of course, has some header information. It has some detailed information about what you purchased. It needs to be updated to the database. Maybe a product catalog has to be updated to tell the owners of that, you know, who bought this. Maybe your user account has to be updated so that you can go back in and download this product on a regular basis. Think about one of those things failing. Should that order still be able to continue? If that is left half-assed like that, that's called an inconsistent state. So that's what I mean by it leaves the system in a consistent state. So the services themselves are rock solid at handling every unit of responsibility they have. They're like a mini application, okay? You had a question?
Yeah, I'm having a hard time. Does that mean a group of super functionality, or are we talking anytime I want to make an action?
Okay. So the question is, he's having a hard time understanding. As far as the unit of responsibility, am I referring to an action? Every time I call an action, you call a service. It all depends on how you write your services. And there's a right and a wrong way, in my opinion, okay? The wrong way is to use services as just CRUD material. Okay? That's what you have the layers underneath for, okay? When I decompose a service, and I don't want to dwell on this too long because now we get into heavy architecture stuff, but when I decompose a system, I work for iDesign, so I go to clients and spend 5 days doing nothing but architecture. And one of the things I help clients do is decompose systems into services so we can lay out an architecture for them. And the first thing I tell them not to do is don't decompose your system functionally. Okay? Because then you're going to have a service that does nothing but add, update, delete, that kind of stuff. Very chatty, very, very chatty. Decompose your system into areas of volatility. Okay?
That makes sense.
And I don't want to dwell on this because we have to keep moving. We got tons of material, but we can certainly, this is a topic I love to talk about. So you catch me during lunch, I'll talk to you some more about that. Sure. No. DTOs are data transfer objects. DTO typically reside right in here, between this layer and this layer, the data access layer and the business engine layer. Those are data transfer objects. An example of a DTO is like the data set. That would be one example. Who still uses the data set here? Oh, thank God, nobody raised their hand. Anybody use strongly typed data sets? Strongly typed data sets, those are STDs. Nobody wants an STD. All right, so along comes a technology to help us do everything that I've just described. This is Windows Communication Foundation. This is the artist formerly known as Indigo. Any Prince fans? Come on, Prince rocks, man. All right, so what WCF does, besides help us orchestrate every detail that I've talked about here, is that it provides us, see, we've had this kind of technology before, but we've had it in a bunch of different sub-technologies. And that was a big pain in the butt because we had to learn a bunch of different things. WCF unifies this stuff. It provides a unified model that brings together the world of web services. How many web service people here? ASMX, good old-fashioned ASMX. Okay. They were a good technology. Problem with web services is that they were very open and they allowed too many mistakes to be made. And I kind of, the analogy that I make to that is conventional ASP.NET web forms, of which I'm still a fan of. I'm not an MVC guy, and I like what they've done with MVC, and I do use MVC, but I still consider myself predominantly a web forms guy because I've learned how to program web forms correctly. The problem with web forms is that they leave themselves open to too many mistakes being made, and that was a problem with web services. And MVC doesn't allow that, which is why it's taken off. Remoting, how many remoting people here? How many remoting people here that like remoting? How many remoting people that like remoting that loved configuring remoting? See how the hands went down? Remote and configuration will make your hair hurt.
It is really, really bad.
But the technology itself had the right idea, and guess what? It hasn't gone away, and I'll explain what that statement means in a second. Sockets, anybody program sockets here? Unless you're programming audio drivers or stuff like that, I see no reason for using sockets anymore. Instead of WCF, the sockets are still around, but they're very, very fast. So if you're programming things at a very, very low level, sockets are the way to go, but they're not the easiest thing to get working. Can we agree on that? I mean, you know, you gotta take things in chunks. You gotta know where the end of marker is. I mean, there's a lot of work to do to get sockets communication working just right. But at the end of the day, it's TCP UDP communication, of which WCF is fully compatible with. With which, enterprise services. Any old enterprise services people here? I didn't raise my hand either. Notice that? I try to avoid it like the plague. Thank God. Thank God it's over. MSMQ. Great technology. When this thing came out in like the late 90s, I think it was 98 or something, I loved it. I used the hell out of it. And then I also used the IBM product, and I think Microsoft has a much better product here than MQ series. All of these technologies are now consolidated with WCF. And what this means is that each one of these technologies has a different way of programming. Not only that, the evidence of what technology you're using is in the code that you're writing. I can look at a class that's meant to be remoted, and I can tell you that this is a remoting class. And how would I know that? Where's it inherited from? The single longest object, base object in Microsoft history. The thing is like 15 characters long. Marshall by ref object, exactly right. Once you see that, what do you think? Remoting, instantly. Web services, you're inheriting from a web service class. The minute you see that. In remoting, if you're not configuring in config file, Your remoting class has to load up some information on there so that it knows how to get remoted. Sockets, forget about it. If you can't tell sockets code by looking at it, really. Enterprise services, definitely a lot of decoration. Also, you have to stick it in the COM Plus manager, so there's a lot of extra work with enterprise services. MSMQ, completely different API. You got to use the MSMQ API. You got to open up a queue. You got to send a message to a queue. You got to post it, purge it, whatever, all that stuff. There's evidence of your transport mechanism in every single one of these technologies. So WCF unifies that into one way of programming. It enforces an SOA approach. It doesn't lock you into it. There's a lot more that you can do with SOA than writing service-oriented classes. You can use it for peer-to-peer communication. You can use it for anything that's message-related. Message is the key word here. Would you agree with that, Don? I know you're really big on that word, message. He's constantly correcting. Every time that I say data contract, he's remember message. It enforces a message-based communication approach. So any kind of application you got to write that involves sending a message to another system, WCF is great for that. It provides a declarative, meaning configuration-based, and pseudo-aspect-oriented. I say pseudo-aspect-oriented because that's what attributes are. So I'm talking about attribute decoration here. Attributes are not truly aspect-oriented, but they're kind of quasi-aspect-oriented. So it provides those two kinds of ways of coding to manage a lot of its functionality. And what I mean by that is to add transaction support, it's a matter of decorating something. To change the way something is instanced or how concurrency works, you don't have to change your business code or your service code. You have to change maybe some configuration and or some decoration. And we're going to cover these things later on in the following hour. So this, it gives you the ability to concentrate on your service logic. Notice I didn't say business logic, because even though you can write business code in your services, typically that's offloaded to down-level calls, to business engines. That can be used from other systems if you wanted to keep them out of the SOA application later. So your service becomes a manager, an orchestrator of different business calls. And you can concentrate on that code now without worrying about how it's going to be transported. The idea is that I can transport something in HTTP one day, which would be analogous to web services, and transport it in TCP another day, which would be analogous to remoting. Now, that's the idea. There are a couple of exceptions to this. One exception I'm not going to get into deeply. The other exception Peter's going to talk about later on, and that is MSMQ and REST. Think about what MSMQ does. MSMQ is about sending a message to a queue and walking away from it. When it gets delivered is not your concern anymore. The whole concept of being able to do that kind of implies that you want your application to be designed to accommodate that. Placing an order on Amazon.com is a perfect situation for queuing. Once you place order, once you click that place order button, you notice that you get your confirmation email from Amazon sometimes 10 seconds later, sometimes an hour later, whenever it gets to their services, to their servers. That's a perfect queuing situation. What if we're writing a service like I'm going to write in a few minutes, which is a service where I send it a zip code and I want a city and state back? Do you want to wait a couple of hours for that response? There's something that does not lend itself to queuing. So you see how the concept of queuing needs to be taken into consideration in your application design. Don't just think that any service you write, I can just do it in TCP today and queuing tomorrow, because what that service does may not lend itself to queuing. REST is the exact same way. And you'll understand, you'll learn all about REST later. Believe me, you're going to walk out of here loving REST. But it's not something that you want to use all the time. There are certain situations where you want REST. And Peter's going to talk more about that later, and I'm going to follow up with a little more at the end of the day. So let's talk about WCF in detail now, okay? We're going to have a little breakdown here of its components. And what time did I start? 9:15, right? Okay. So we're going to have a breakdown of its components, and then we're going to dive into some code. And most of the rest of this session is going to be code, since you didn't really come here to see a lot of PowerPoint stuff. So the world of WCF is included. By the way, WCF was introduced in .NET 3.0, so it's already a few years old. When was 3.0 brought into the picture? 2006. Yeah, late 2006, I believe he's right. You were close. So that's already, I mean, we're going on 4 years here. So it's not a brand new technology. It's part of the .NET 3.0 stack, and everything originally was included in one namespace, system.service model. And most everything that we'll use, with few exceptions that you'll learn later, is in a namespace called system.service model. I'm sorry, I meant to say assembly first. But all of that is in the system service model assembly. Now, in .NET 3.5, they introduced the system.service model.web assembly, which is where all the REST stuff is located, because REST compatibility was added in 3.5, and then in 4.0, they upgraded that, and Peter will talk more about what's included there. And in 4.0, we've gotten a couple of other assemblies, too, regarding discovery and routing and stuff like that. So that's the assembly. That's where everything is housed. These are elements that we're going to be discussing and coding in just a few minutes. We got the concept of data contracts. We got the concept of service contracts. We got services themselves. We got a service host, a client proxy, and we got some configuration. You're going to get intimate with all of these things in the next hour, or less than an hour, actually, because we're going to be using every single one of these. Each one of these things is necessary for you to write a service-oriented application using WCF. There are some corners you can cut, and I hesitate to tell you where they are, but I don't want you to read them out of a book and say, oh, I didn't know you can do this. Miguel never told us this. I'm going to tell you you can do these things, and I'm going to tell you not to do them. So to do it the right way, these are the things you're going to be dealing with on a regular basis. So let's take this step by step, because this is my approach. Once I got my architecture diagrammed out for a customer and I know what services I'm going to want, this is the way I jump into the code. The first thing I do is go into and start thinking about my service contracts. My service contracts are the contract between a client and the service. These are the one point. This is a point of commonality that's going to be shared by both sides of the wire, because the service doesn't care how the clients communicate with it, and the clients don't care the service implementation details. But they both care about what the skeleton is, what the service has to offer. The client needs to know that, and the service needs to know that because it has to offer it. And this is done by way of contracts. And contracts, with that definition I just gave you, that should kind of imply that we're talking about definition only and not implementation. Sound okay? Now, if I tell you definition and not implementation, what as a regular CLR .NET programmer, what's the first thing that comes to your mind? Interfaces. So a contract, and I got it right there, you cheaters. All right, so a contract essentially is just an interface, and it's an interface that's decorated with an attribute called service contract. And then every operation in, and by the way, it's an interface with methods only. It's got no properties. You're exposing, you're deciding what you're going to expose. And you're going to decide that by writing methods. And those methods get decorated with another attribute, hence becoming operation contracts. Now, I want you to get used to this terminology for the entire day, because I'm going to stop calling these things interfaces, and I'm going to stop calling their members methods. We're going to be using WCF language here. So I'm going to be referring to them as a service contract and I'm going to be referring to the methods as operations. We're clear on that terminology? I don't want to hear anybody say interface or method. So once I figure out what operations I want to expose, I need to figure out what data those operations are going to expose and what data those operations are going to need coming in. So think about it. The example that we're going to do here, and I've been doing this example for a while, and I don't want to change it because it's just really easy for me to get going on it, is some kind of geo-region service, something that I can tack on a bunch of operations. I almost said methods. A bunch of operations that expose information about regional data. Maybe it's a service that's sitting in front of a huge geographical database that has all sorts of latitude, longitude, zip code, postal code, information, area code, and I want to expose this stuff to the outside world. So I got a very simple database that has all my cities and states and zip codes, and I want to expose a service that allows you to send in a zip code, and it's going to return to you a city and a state. Very, very simple. We'll keep it simple for our first example, okay? So we already know what our service contract is. Our service contract is going to be some interface that is called, regional service or something like that. And the operations are going to be what the client's going to be able to call. So simple would be get city state, for example. That would be an operation. And the data that this contract is going to expose is going to be a city state for that operation, and the data coming into it is going to be a zip code. Do you understand my thought process here and the way I'm designing the service? Now, my next element is going to be the service class itself. The service class itself is going to be the implementer of this service contract. And this is the class that is going to have the code in it that provides the information that I'm exposing in the data contracts. And how I obtain that information is entirely up to me. I'm going to try to use good architecture practices because I'm calling down to a business layer. I want to practice what I preach here. But technologically, nothing stops me from, in my service code itself, just opening up a SQL connection and calling a SQL server. I can certainly do that. I just wouldn't want to. It's not my way of doing it. Now, once this class is all done, it's just sitting there as a class and nobody knows anything about it. This is where hosting comes into play. Hosting is a listener application that exposes your services on a wire, so that clients can call in and find out that they're there and call them and get their information. And hosting in WCF takes three different shapes. IIS is one way of hosting, and I'm going to show that later on. Self-hosting is the one that I'm going to use. Self-hosting is basically any application. Any app can be a host. A Windows app, a console app. I'm going to use a console app to be quick and simple. A WPF app can be a host. A lot of people like to do NT services. Remember NT services? They still exist, and they're very easy to program in .NET. So you can use an NT service and then start and stop your host in a nicely organized fashion. So self-hosting is any application. WAS is an interesting one. WAS is Windows Process Activation Service. So it should be WPAS, but it's not. It's WAS. And WAS is a product that's shipped only with Vista 2008 or Windows 7. So if you're using XP or 2000, you don't have WAS, you can't use WAS. WAS allows you to break some of the limitations of IIS while maintaining the simplicity of IIS. It's easy to host an IIS because you don't have to write any code. WAS uses IIS to manage itself, but a limitation of IIS is that it can only expose things to one protocol, HTTP, while self-hosting allows you to expose to any protocol. WAS lets you use any protocol. So this is what I just said. So IIS could only host HTTP services. Self-hosting can be anything. It can host MSMQ. It can host TCP, which is very fast. It can host name pipes. We'll talk about bindings later on. WAS can be any of those protocols, yet it maintains the simplicity of IIS, but it's only available on these, I should say Windows 7 there, shouldn't it? Okay, I want to make sure the recording gets this. Available in Vista, Server 2008, and Windows 7. All right, so let's create some of this stuff. Let's jump into code. Got 98 attendees. All right, so I want to introduce you to this project here, okay? I got a project. Now, normally I would use my ZoomIt application, which is a Microsoft application. I can use ZoomIt here, so I can do this, and it's recording just fine?
Oh, beautiful. All right. So
this is my solution, and I've kind of prepped this so I don't, you know, bore you with creating projects and solutions. I got a business layer all ready to go. Okay. So I got a business layer here called WCFtraining.business, and this contains my business objects, my business engines. I don't want to hear any criticism on how I did it. At least I put together a business layer for you guys, okay? But I'm not really accessing a data access layer here. I'm not accessing a database. I've hard-coded this stuff in the code. So as you can see, if I go to the zip code collection, for example, I actually have a hard-coded collection. In real life, this would obviously be retrieving a collection from the database, as there are more than just 5 zip codes in our country. So I got my business layers all ready to go, okay? So what I'm going to do is that I want to expose this business layer because it may do 150 different things. I don't want my service to do that. I don't want to give out my business layer to the world. I just want to expose my service to do the things that I want to manage. So I want to let you call a service that is going to return a city state if you send it a zip code. Sound easy enough? So the first thing I do is that I have a project here called contracts. Now, this is the first best practice I'm going to show you, and everything that I'm doing here is going to follow what I consider to be best practices, okay? I'm not showing you anything that I don't recommend you use. I am separating my contracts out in their own assembly. The reason for that is because, as I said at the beginning, contracts are the one piece of information, the one element in WCF that is going to be shared by both sides. Now, I'll talk about alternatives to that, possible alternatives at the end of the session. But for right now, I'm putting everything in one assembly there because I want both sides to know about this, okay? So I'm going to go ahead and add an interface here. And I'll call this interface iRegional. All right, so I got an interface. Let's make it public. And I believe I've already referenced system service model. Yes, I have. This is very important. Start thinking of this as the new system, okay? Everything you do in the world of WCF is going to reference this DLL, so just get used to including it in your application. Another assembly of interest that I'll mention now and then talk about in about 5 minutes is system.runtime serialization. So I went ahead and I added that assembly there, and I'll explain why in a couple of minutes. So here's my iRegional, and I'm going to say system service model. And right now, is this an interface or is it a service contract? Charles says it's an interface. Who agrees with him? No, it's an interface. It's just an interface, man. Now what is it? Thank you. Now you're catching on. All right. So now we got a service contract here, which means when this is hosted, clients will be able to ping a certain address and know that there's a service called iRegional. And what's that service going to expose? Well, whatever I want it to expose. So I want it to expose probably something, some kind of object that looks like this. I'm sorry, Don. It's not an object. It is a message. And I'm going to say get zip info. And this is going to require a piece of information, which is really just a zip code. Now, is this a method or is it an operation? It's a method. There you go. Now you understand the pattern. Now what is it? It's an operation. All right, so we have our first service contract. Unfortunately, we don't have this thing here, so it's not going to compile yet. So we know what we want to expose. We're shaping our API. This is essentially what we're writing is an API. So we're shaping our API. And we know we need to return some zip code data. Now, this is going to be important because I have to create this contract. This is what's going to be called a data contract, which gets serialized and turned into a message. I didn't use a contract here. A data contract is only required when you have something other than simple types. So if all you have is a single slash simple type, like an int or a double or a float or a string, you can just use them. The minute you have to return more than one, you have to wrap it in a data contract. Now, if I needed to send more than one piece of information into this contract, for example, if I needed to send zip code with an additional Boolean and maybe an integer, with your area code or something like that for whatever reason. I have choices because coming in, this is standard method argument technology that we're using. So I can just say string zip code, comma, int, whatever, comma, and the next one. But if I wanted to be a little more organized, I can create another data contract that wraps those things up and sends that in as one argument. You understand? Now, for outgoing, I have no choice because I don't want to use out arguments because I don't use them anyway. I hate those things. I only have one way out of this method. So if I'm returning more than one thing, which I am here, I have to use an object or a data contract. So I'm going to go ahead and create that class. So there's my class there, and get rid of the constructor because I don't need it. And the zip code data is going to include a city property, and it's going to include a state property. And you know what? Let's give it the zip code in there as well, just to be redundant. Now, right now, we have a class, not a data contract yet, not until I decorate it with the data contract attribute, okay? Now, all data contracts are data shapes. They're classes without behavior. That's what makes them a message. They're classes that contain information so they can be serialized and sent through the wire, okay? That being said, you can feel free to use the shortcut way of coding properties. In my opinion, no reason to use member variables with public properties. You're never going to put any code inside the get and the set. So you might as well just use the shortest way to code it as possible.
There's no way to do a private
set. Okay, so the question is there a way to do a private set? Well, technologically, yes. I can stick the word private right there, and it's going to work just fine as long as this one is public. But I wouldn't want to do that. Remember, this is going to be serialized. So it needs to be able to take stuff out and put stuff in, and the framework's going to do that for us. So it's not something that you do in WCS. These classes serve one purpose, okay, and I want to stress that. Do not put behavior in here. Do not use these as business objects. Do not use them anywhere else in your application except your contracts assembly as the messages that WCF is going to pass around the wire. That's the only purpose they serve. And the quid pro quo, it has to be talked about too. Do not use business objects as the data contracts. Do not think that just because you have a really cool business object with the same property that you can just tack on data contract and now I got a data contract and I can use it for both purposes. Please do not do that. That's why I said earlier, it is writing a little more code in some situations, but it's not always going to turn out to be one-to-one. And what I mean by that, and I get this to clients, at customers all the time, we got a business layer that has zip code information. So I may have a zip code object that has city, state, and zip in there. Now I want to expose that as a service. So I'm going to write a data contract, and I start out with city, state, and zip in my data contract. Hey, that's kind of identical. The client immediately asks, why don't I just pass the business object? That was a mistake that web services let you do. It lets you just serialize anything. But the idea with data contracts is that sometimes they may be one-to-one with a business object. Sometimes they may be a subset of a business object. Sometimes they may be a union of more than one business object. The idea is to keep data contracts as slim as possible, okay? So if my business object has city, state, and zip, but all I really, really need for this operation to work is city and state, then that really should be all I'm giving it. Because remember, this information is going to travel through the wire. So make it as fine-tuned as slim as possible.
We got an online question wondering on the interface there for the service contract. Does it need to be declared public, or is that implicitly implied?
No, it does not. That's a good question. Does it need to be declared publicly? It doesn't. It'll still work. I do it publicly because I share my contract. So basically, it has to be declared depending on what the scope of use is going to be. So if my interfaces are going to be in the same assembly as my services, then obviously they don't need to be public. They need to be a minimum of internal. But then I would need to have copies of them at the proxy side, which we'll get into later, because the proxy is going to need to know about the interfaces as well. So I would have to have a duplicate of that at the proxy side. Because I wrote my interfaces in a contract DLL that's going to be shared by both sides, I'm declaring them public so that everything that's inside this assembly can be exposed to whatever is going to reference it later. Does that make sense? You got that? Okay, so we still have just an object here, okay? We have to do something here to make this a data contract. This is where system runtime serialization comes in, the assembly and the namespace. Microsoft, in a burst of thinking ahead, decided that this is a good serializer because it's a brand new serializer. It's kind of like serializer but works a little differently. They decided they may be able to leverage this in future things other than WCF. So they didn't put it as part of WCF. They put it into the serialization assembly so that future things can use it without getting into the world of WCF. So now I got my data contract. Now, this is an opt-in serializer, which means it's more than just decorating with serializer and then away you go. You have to decorate it, number one, with a different attribute called data contract. Number two, your members do not form part of the serialization stream unless you opt them in with the data member. If you forget that, it will be like if it doesn't exist. Very important. It's an opt-in model. Now, for the record, WCF 4.0 has eliminated the need to do that. My recommendation is ignore that and do it anyway. I don't like the fact that they did that. I'll say it on the record here. I think they should have left it as a forced model. They wanted to get old developers that weren't used to decorating everything able to use WCF without worrying about remembering to do this. My return to that is remember to do it. If your application breaks, then you got something to fix. But explicitness is your friend here. If we didn't need explicitness, we'd be programming in Visual Basic. I shouldn't say that because I love VB.
Why would it really matter? Because if you are creating a class just for the purpose of exposing your data that goes over the wire, why would it really matter? You obviously want to have your class with the members that you want to.
So why would it matter? Okay, the best answer. Okay, so the question is why does it really matter? Why do I consider it important to decorate them when I'm explicitly creating this class for the purpose of serializing and sending stuff through the wire on a service? The easy answer to that question, and the one that I'm going to stick with, is the fact that by looking at this physically, I can tell you exactly what kind of class this is without having to go through my project tree and say, oh, yeah, it's a contract. What is it? It's a system service model. Oh, I must be using this for WCF messaging. No, I can look at this wherever it sits and tell you this is a data contract class. Which means if I overlook somebody's shoulder and I see them write a method on this class, I can slap them on the backside of the head and feel good about myself. It forces this, but it doesn't force this.
Okay.
A reason for having a member that would, I'll give you a better answer, okay, not the funny one. That was funny though, wasn't it? So I may have a public property here called display that returns city, comma, state, space, zip code, or maybe an override of two strings, which would be the better way of doing it, right? And now I want to use that because my client is going to receive this data back. I'd make it easy for my client to just display this by binding to that property, but I don't want that property to travel. So that's why I want to explicitly say these are going to be my traveling members. The other one is just nice to have. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And that's really why I don't like what they did by removing the need to do this. All right, so let's put this out in its own. Oops, hold on a second. Let's put this out in its own file. There we go. So now we got our contract. Yes. That's correct. That's correct. That's correct. Now, once you tag one with data member, you have to do all of them or the ones that you want. So the easy thing to remember is, you see, that's why I shouldn't have opened up that can of worms. So let's close this topic by saying ignore what they did and decorate things properly. It doesn't take a lot of work to do this, and it'll force your brain to think more. Huh? Oh. All right, so we got our contract, we got our service contract, we got our data contract. Everything seems cool so far. Now we have the negotiating element for both sides of the wire. The service knows the contract because it knows what it needs to implement and expose. The client is going to know about the contract because it knows what it can call and what it's going to return. Now I'm going to jump to another project. This project is called Services. And this project is going to reference, of course, system service model, but it's also going to reference my contract, and it's going to reference anything else that I'm going to need to get the job done. Because this is where my services are going to reside, and my services are going to be the implementation of my service contracts. So whatever the implementation code needs to do, this needs to access. Remember, you don't need to go to a business layer, then go to a database. Your services may be designed to work with an XML file. It may be designed to hard code something. Your services may be calling an API on the other side of the world, hosted by, you know, IBM somewhere. Whatever it takes to get the job done, that's what the service assembly is going to require. In my case, it's going to require my contract and my business layer, which is what you see right there. So now I'm going to go into my services project, and I'm going to create a new service. And the service is going to be nothing more than a class. I'll call it regional service. And let's go ahead and, even though I don't think I'm going to be using anything from here, and I am going to need my contracts. So now I have a class here, and this class starts out as a class implementing an interface. But in WCF terminology, what do we say? The service implementing a service contract. So here's my iRegional. Come on. I can do it with CodeRush too. I just forget the keystroke. If I would have given you a shirt earlier, I'd take it away. All right. So I got a class, implements my interface, service, implements my service contract. There's my implementation requirements, and now I do whatever it is that I need to do. So I don't remember exactly what this is. I'll try to wing it here. I think we're doing really good on time. So let's go to the business layer. And I think I can say zip code collection, all zips equals, and I think I had a factory method on here called load. Yep. There we go. So I'm just writing business code now. And I believe that I can say zip code. Zip code is my business object. And real quickly, let me talk about naming conventions, okay? Did you notice I put the word data after my data contract? That's my own personal preference, and it seems to be an industry-accepted preference, which means I didn't make it up. We use it at iDesign all the time. Juval actually has on the iDesign website a whole document on WCF code guidelines that you may want to download for free and check it out. And this is one of the conventions. Use the word data, and that also helps you differentiate your business objects from your data objects or your message objects or your data contracts. Okay? Zip code is just a business object, so I'm going to say zip equal all zips, and I think I have a find method in here. This is all business logic that I wrote ahead of time. So there should be a find by zip. There it is right there. And it wants a zip code in the IntelliSense. So look what I got here. I got a zip code that came in to this service. Now I just returned a zip code business object. Now that I have the information in my business object, can I just return this? If I wanted to make that serializable and do it, I can do that, but now I got a business object going up the wire. We're completely breaking our architecture practice here. So I need to build this. And how you do it is entirely up to you. If you feel that your system is going to have a lot of one-to-ones where the business object has a corresponding data contract, then write yourself a helper utility to use reflection to kind of, you know, import one into the other, by all means. If anybody uses the CSLA framework, your Rocky Laka CSLA framework, he actually has a helper utility in that framework that does exactly that for this very purpose. I'm going to do it the hard way here, okay? I'm going to define an object called data. And I'm just going to set data.city equals zip.city, data.state equals zip that state. I think at minimum in a real world scenario, you'd probably be using the constructor for this or something. There we go. And I just built my data. Now, I say again, this looks one-to-one, but it doesn't always have to be. This piece of information can come from one object, while this one may come from another one. And this one may come from the combination of two other ones. So there may be a difference in the future, even though it doesn't appear like that today. And now, I'm just going to say return data. And now I got my first service. And it's written well, because I've actually accessed the business layer. Just don't tell anybody that I've hard-coded the load instead of going out to a database. All right. So let's compile this to see if it works or if it compiles. Okay, everything compiles, right? Compilation is your first unit test. Can we agree with that? All right. We passed our first unit test. All right. Now, this right now is a class, and it's just sitting out there. It's not doing a damn thing. So I have to host this class somewhere, and this is where my host comes in. And I got this host all ready to go for you here. It's nothing more than a console app. There's some people in this room that hate console apps for demos. See, I'm laughing back there. It's nothing but a console app, and for hosting, it works well, okay? You can use a Windows app for this. It doesn't matter. Yes? No, what I said is that the service should do this one area, it should accomplish this one area of volatility, which in our case is the exposure of geographical data. That's what the service does. How it does it, this is the how right here. This is what's limited. The what is limited, so you don't want to put any more what's in your service that don't relate to what the service is designed for. But the how, it can go anywhere it wants for its information. So the question is if the information that built this data here came from more than one source, should the sources be part of this assembly? Or should they be somewhere else?
Right.
Well, right away, I'm going to tell you they should be somewhere else.
Right.
Because even this stuff is somewhere else. I mean, look at the business layer that I'm calling here is up here. It's another assembly.
So your objective should be that always it should be one-to-one, is what you are saying, right?
No. No, if I needed another business engine, let's say I have my business layer divided into three different engines. Those are three different DLLs. I'd reference the three DLLs from my services project. And now I'd instantiate those objects in here. If it also required some XML information, I'd, you know, load up the XML data in here. My assembly is going to read, my service assembly is going to have my services only, but it's going to reference everything that it needs in order to get the job done to accomplish this task. That's a method in my business layer that I wrote earlier, that I had it all prepared. All right, let's continue. And does that answer your question good enough so we can continue and then we can talk about it more later?
Yeah.
Okay, thanks. Just hold on to anything else that you have so we can continue. All right, so I got to do my host now. My host is an application that is referencing my system service model, of course, and it's referencing my contracts and it's referencing my services. We're still working on the server side of the pipe here. Okay, so now I'm going to open up this console application, and as you can see, I've already got my little write lines there and everything. I'm going to say using system service model, and I'm going to say WCF training.services. And the way I host something, the easy way of hosting, is to instantiate a class called the service host class. The service host class is how a service is hosted. Even in IIS, the service host class is used. The only difference is that IIS is actually doing the job for you by instantiating this class. Here, we're self-hosting, so we're instantiating it manually. Every service requires one instance of the service host class. So if you're hosting 50 services in this host, you need 50 instances of this. Did you have a question, or are you just stretching? You're just stretching? You're killing me, man. So I'm just going to call this host. And now, whoops, sorry. That was stupid. Nobody caught me on that. What I am instantiating in the service host, what I'm throwing into the constructor, is the type of my service, which in this case is called regional service. And that's how you tie a host to a service. Now we got to open the host, because until we open this, it's not running. Now it's going to run. Now this host is going to require a little more information. Everybody with me so far? All right, so let's go back to the slides real quick. All right. So this is the way we configure our service. And the reason we need to configure it is because the service host is going to require some information in order to do its job. That information can be provided to it in two different ways, either programmatically or declaratively. Ultimately, it will always be programmatically, because if it finds something in a configuration file, it turns it into the object model it needs in order to host itself properly. If I don't provide configuration, I have to programmatically provide the object model. Understand? There's some minimum information that is required to host, and you're going to learn that minimum one here, and then we're going to add significantly to this in the following hour. Okay? Everything in the world of WCF is configured through the system service model configuration section. Now, you can do two things in WCF configuration. You can either be a host or you can be a client. You can certainly be both, and you're going to see an example of both in the latter part of the next session when we do transactions. Here I'm hosting, so I'm going to be a host. I need a services section, and everything is very logically named. As you can see, because we have a services section, that implies that we're going to have one or more service sections. So we're going to have how many service sections in this host? Just one, because we got one service. We're going to have the name of the service here. Now, this is a nomenclature that I completely disagree with. Everywhere in the config file where you refer to a .NET type, it's usually a type equals. We see it all over the place in config files. Oh, not in WCF. It's got to be different. So it's called name. Don't let that throw you off, okay? This is the fully qualified type of the service. So our service was wcftraining.services.regionalservice, right? That's what's going to be there. And it throws people off, which is why I'm mentioning it, okay? It's not the word Miguel. It's not a friendly name. It is the type of the service. They just call it name. It should really be changed. Inside goes something called the endpoint, called the endpoint. And every service needs a minimum of one endpoint to be exposed. The endpoint calls what we call the ABCs of WCF, which is the address, the binding, and the contract. The address is a URL where clients can find the service. The binding determines what transport mechanism is going to be used to broadcast the service. Is it HTTP? Is it TCP? Is it queuing? Is it REST? Is it whatever? And the contract is going to be just that, the service contract. So by me telling you that the service needs one or more endpoints, and by you seeing that the endpoint is at a contract level, that should automatically imply in your mind that if I have a service that implements more than one service contract, that service is going to have as many endpoints as it has service contracts, unless you don't want them exposed. And there are good reasons for that, because I may want to have a service called regional service that implements two contracts. One of them is for all the publicly exposed operations, and the other ones are for some administrative operations, like the maintenance of the database. And I may want to expose those in two different endpoints. Yet, I want to put them in the same service, even though they're two different contracts, because I may want to leverage some additional private helper code methods that are inside the service that both implementations are going to share. Does that make sense? But for the exposure, they're going to be exposed in two different endpoints. The public one is going to be exposed in HTTP for the world to see, and the private one is going to be exposed in NetTCP with some added security to it so the world cannot see it. That's a quick reason as to why you want to do that. So let's configure this host. I'm getting used to this. instead of Alt-Tab. I almost caught myself with Alt-Tab. All right, so if I run this host now, it's actually going to tell me that it's missing something. And the message is actually pretty descriptive. This might be because no configuration was found. Might is the CYA part of this statement. I'm going to go ahead and add an item to this, application configuration file. Huh? Oh, I did? Oh, you're absolutely right. There we go. System service model, services, service name equals WCF training dot services, regional service. You have no IntelliSense here, so be very careful. And we need an endpoint with an address, binding, and contract. And the address, we'll make it a localhost. I'll do it on port 8008. Now this can be anything you want. I can call it regional service, but if I call it regional service, you may think that it has to be the same name as the service, and it doesn't. I'm just going to say Miguel here. And I'm going to say basic HTTP binding, and we'll talk about bindings at the end. And is this what it was called? Okay, let's run this and see if it works. Service is started. So it looks like we're cool. Now, in the interest of time, because we have 10 minutes left, do you guys mind if I show you the client side of this by staying in the code instead of going back to the slides? Nobody rather, you guys rather see PowerPoint? No? All right. So we got our services. They're hosted, and we know that we're exposing this at this address through this kind of communication protocol. Clients will be able to see the operations exposed by this contract. Does that statement make sense? So now for clients to do this,
you have anything? Yeah, go ahead. I have a question.
Go ahead, please.
So we have a question online wanting to know, why should I host myself instead of IIS? What would be the pros and cons of that?
Okay, so the question is, you talked into it, so it's recorded already. So why expose like this instead of through IIS? Well, it's a good question. The first and foremost one is that IIS has a limitation of HTTP. So you cannot expose anything except HTTP through IIS. So if you're doing things in-house, if you're doing things in an intranet scenario, you don't want to use HTTP. If your services are not going to be public, why go through the burden of a text protocol that clearly has more overhead? Use NetTCP, which is much, much faster, and IIS cannot handle that. Now, WAS can handle that. So it's similar to IIS, but it can handle the additional protocol. That's the immediate answer.
Okay, and we have one other question wanting to know, if you are doing your own host, would it be a good practice to name the host something like service name?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Service
name host.
Yep, that's actually an excellent question. And the reason I just called it host is because I have one service to show you. But usually I use host as a preface for a name that I'm going to give it. So I may have a service called regional service. I may have a service called commerce service. I may have a service called customer service. And if I want to host all three of them, I would then have a host regional, host customer, and host commerce name. Got that?
Yep.
All right, so we have our host ready to go. Now our clients need to connect to it. Now, if we hand out this address, you're going to be able to just say add service reference to this address and add the reference, just like you used to for ASMX web services. Yes. You got to raise your voice. I'm sorry. No, I'm going to talk about bindings at the end. So he's asking if the address has to be HTTP. No, I'm using a basic HTTP binding here, which is why the protocol header says HTTP. If I was using NetTCP binding, it would say net.tcp:// Okay, one more. What was it, say again? The service host class, where does it come from? It comes from system, that service model, from that namespace and that DLL. Okay? All right, so add service reference is a quick way of pinging the service and being able to access it. The bad part about add service reference, and a lot of times you may not have a choice because the guy that wrote the service may be in the other side of the world. It may be a WCF service that you heard about and you thought it'd be cool to use, and you have to add a service reference. But if you're the guy doing the work, and notice me speeding up because we're running out of time. If you're the guy doing the work, then you're going to be sharing your contracts, which means you can do this stuff manually. And manually provides a lot cleaner code. In order to do this stuff manually, I'm going to need to write a proxy class. And I like to put my proxy class inside my contract assembly. The reason I like to do that is because the services are going to need the contracts. The clients are going to need the contracts. The services are going to need the services. The clients are going to need the proxies. But your service may be calling another service, for all you know, now or in the future, which means your service may become a client of another service, in which case it will require a proxy to that service. So I just find it cleaner and easier to house my proxies, my data contracts, and my service contracts all in one assembly, which is why I'm putting it in here. So I'm going to put it in here, and I'm going to call it regional client, which is an industry-accepted naming convention, the word client. And I'm going to say using system service model, and I'm inheriting this class from something called client base. This is the magic class to create a proxy. This is what Visual Studio generates for you, but it's not hard to code yourself. Client base has one generic requirement, and the generic requirement is your service contract. The additional thing you got to do in the proxy class is go ahead and implement your service contract, because that'll also give you an easy way of generating the skeleton methods. Now what you have here is you have a class called regional client that has the same methods as your service. But you're not having service implementation code here. The job of this class is to establish all the communication channels between the client and the service. That's the job of client base. That's why you inherit from that. So you don't have to do any of this work. All you have to do here is delegate the call out to the channel property of client base, which now, thanks to the generic requirement being met, has methods of that interface. And I can just send in the information right into there. So now my proxy is done. And if I had 50 more operations on this contract, I would have 50 more methods, and they would all just delegate the call out to the channel property. That's all it's doing. Now I end up with an object called regional client. If I give this object to a user that's developing a Windows Forms application, like I'm about to hear, all they have to know about is that I got a cool little object that I can call, and it gets zip info as a method on it, and it's going to return what I want. They don't really have to have the knowledge of what takes place behind the scenes of that class, which is quite a bit. So now to use this proxy, I'm going to go out to my client. I got this great client here. And it's got a button and a text box, and the text box is called text zip code, and it's got a label called LBL city, LBL state. Here's a search. Let's go ahead and do this. So I'm going to make sure that I am referencing from that client the information. Oh, no, that's the wrong one. I already am. I'm referencing the contracts. I need the contracts and the proxies, and they're both included in the contract assembly, so I got what I need. I don't need the business layer. That's behind the service wall. I don't need the services. That's behind the service wall. I just need the contracts. I need to know the definition of what it is that I'm able to access. So in this search button here, I'm now going to say, import our where did I put this? Oh, it's in contracts? I'll put it in contracts. Why not? Leave it in there. Okay, so it's called regional client. Proxy equals new regional client. And I'm going to say zip code data. Data equals, let's make a call to the proxy. Send the zip code in, which is in the text box. And now, of course, I'd be checking for null and doing all kinds of error checking if I had more time. And I'll look at the proxy dispose itself. That should be cool. We need one final piece, and that is we need configuration information. This proxy is going to need the same information the service needed. It's going to need an endpoint. The service needed it to expose something. The proxy needs it to consume something. So, say what? Kind of, sort of. I am going to do a little copy-paste. So here's system service model, but instead of services, I have a client section. Now, in services, I had services, and I had service, and then I had my service defined, and then a bunch of endpoints. The client doesn't give a damn about services anymore. The client just cares about what service contract is going to interact with and what operations within those contracts. So the client just needs a bunch of endpoints. So this is where Charles is right, and I can just take this endpoint here, and I'm going to copy it right into here. And now I can run my host and my client. So let's go ahead and run the host. And let's go ahead and kick off the client. And let's enter a zip code. Okay, everybody pray for the demo gods. I've written everything here from scratch, man. My goal is to prove to you that this is easy enough where I don't have to have pre-canned code. I can write all this from scratch in front of you guys. We got it. Cool. Here's my old hometown. There we go. Now, in case you think that I'm messing with you and that I have completely fooled you by coding this into a business object, let's do one final approval test here. I just brought down the host. Now I'm going to do a search. And now after a little bit of a timeout, there we go. And look what the error message says. Could not connect to blah, 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 which is the endpoint address. Not too difficult, right? I know we're supposed to stop now. If you can indulge me for 2 minutes, I can get through the rest of the slides. One question only. Go ahead.
How can we handle security?
Oh, you got to be kidding. How can we handle security? Dude, don't even try. I'm going to be real blunt and say I refuse to answer that on the grounds that it'll... No, we can talk about security a little later, but I cannot open up that can of worms. In fact, I don't have a security session for this day because it's so big a topic. I cover it in one little slide at the end of the day. So it's a huge topic. My five-day WCF class, which you're welcome to take, I spend the whole fifth day on security, the entire day. It's a massive, massive topic. I'm sorry I have to be that blunt, but there's just no way.
I guess you could sum it up by saying the answer is yes, you can.
You definitely can. Absolutely. Definitely can. So these are the different bindings available to you, okay? And this is kind of a little logic decision tree here as to how you choose a binding. I chose a basic HTTP binding, which is an unsecure binding, and it exposes publicly through HTTP. So it's kind of like the lowest common denominator. But if you're staying inside a firewall and you're using .NET to .NET, NetTCP binding is your best choice, because it's faster, significantly faster than HTTP. It just can't traverse firewalls. The same limitation that remoting had. In fact, it's using remoting technology behind the scenes. If you're using queuing, use NetMSMQ binding. If you're accessing services on the same physical box machine that your clients are on, and there's a lot of good reasons for doing this, you can write service applications that are housed in one box only, you use NetName pipe binding. Because NetName pipe has a limitation that it doesn't cross machine boundaries, but it is the single fastest binding available. It's even faster than TCP. So additional technologies that we're going to talk about in the following session, transactions, we're going to talk about them. We're not going to talk about throttling, but we are going to cover instancing and concurrency. There's all sorts of different technologies that WCF brings into the picture. The ability to do callbacks. Your client can now become a service and wait for a callback from the service. There's all sorts of funky things you can do. These are all characteristics that WCF services benefit from. And I'm not just going to read them out. I'll let you view this on your own time. It's all different things that your application can benefit from. I will say that this is the existence of these things are a perfect reason for having a service-based application that does not travel the wire. The client and the service are on the same box. Your host is one little application, and your client is another app. Or your host is within the same application as the client. You just want to benefit from all of this stuff. So it is an SOA application, but it doesn't get exposed. Yes, sir. Totally.
Could you show us switching from one to the other?
Yeah, sure. I can do that. Let me get through this, and I'll show you. As soon as I say, okay, we're breaking, I'll do it. Okay? So benefits to SOA. This is an important slide that I wanted to mention, okay? Some of you may be asking, okay, this is a lot of work, and it certainly is, and it's a lot of architecture work, too. Why is this important to me, okay? What is SOA really going to give me? Well, number one, it's going to give me location independence, okay? Your services and their implementation and all the magic that they do can be located anywhere in the world. Your client doesn't have to know anything about them except an address of where to find them. So the distribution of DLLs becomes basically non-existent. Interoperability is absolutely key here, okay? This stuff can be exposed to Java clients, to COBOL clients, if you're a real glutton for punishment, to Ruby, Perl. Anybody can read the simple text protocols like HTTP. How they parse them is their own problem. We got the luxury of those beautiful proxy classes, but that's a .NET thing. Java's got its own way of writing proxy classes. Ruby's got its own way of doing it and its own way of opening up communication channels. But the data is there. It's available. The organization is much better than object distribution because of the location independence. The coupling is loose. Okay, it's definitely loose coupling. There is no circular reference problems. There is no I need to reference this business object or that one. I can get into arguments about coupling another time. Your business information can now be exposed across the enterprise, and if properly secured, all your teams can benefit from it. That should save you time and not having to write the same code twice. We know that in big banking firms, they don't care about that. They love to write the same code twice. We have a lot of security functionality built in WCF that you benefit from, a lot of other characteristics. So there's a lot of benefits to SOA. I'm not going to waste additional time just giving you a summary here. Just going to say WCF enforces SOA. It doesn't lock you into it, but it definitely enforces this practice. Very, very flexible technology here. And I got some great references. We got a couple of these books here to give out later on. And that's it for this one. And that's it for this session, and I'll go ahead and do what you want me to do with the option of everybody standing up and going to lunch. Actually, it's not lunch. It's just a break. It's not lunch. It's not lunch. It's just a break.
So for everybody here.